Thanks, Keith. I, as usual, have a lot of information, so I'm going to go pretty quickly through it. The American Carbon Registry was the first voluntary greenhouse gas registry set up in 1996, and because of our affiliation with Windrock International, we've always been particularly interested in the agricultural sector. And so what I want to do today is tell you why emissions from agriculture are important and maybe put some numbers on some of the things that Adam had in his presentation, and a little bit about what role markets can possibly play and then how science can make markets work better. I'm going to focus in on a particular example from rice in Arkansas in the Mid-South. So I want to kind of use that as a way to get at some of the issues and problems. Why is agriculture important? Because food security is not negotiable. We all know that. It underlies peace and prosperity. We have to at least double food production in the next 30 years. That's accounting both for population growth and the health, the more nutritious diets that people want to have with higher protein contents. And so how does productivity matter? So this particular paper, it's an old paper, it came out in 2010 from Bernie, but this paper had a big effect on the conversations I've been having around the world. We were associated with the Green Revolution technologies, and to a certain extent at Windrock, we never live up to our past because Norm Borlaug was on our founding board of directors, and he was filling the soccer stadiums in Pakistan with grain, and he was doing it using markets, and he felt, and so did many of the founding board members, that they had rightfully bought the planet, you know, a couple of decades to solve its distribution problems, only to find that we sort of squandered that time. But looking at the numbers, in terms of the success of that particular activity, it avoided about 161 gigatons. So if you look at the total emissions, human emissions between 1815 and 2005, it's only 478. And so if you just look at what was the result of agricultural intensification investments, you had this sort of dramatic impact, even at the global scale in a sector that, you know, now doesn't get a lot of, because it's a relatively small percentage, but has been a very, you know, important contributor. And so these numbers that Bernie put together are an average for all crops on all cropland. And so there's a lot of number crunching that went behind these. But without the increased yields that were achieved in the Green Revolution, we would have needed an extra 1.5 billion hectares of cropland. And so if you use the numbers behind the sort of IPCC numbers for what's the typical carbon stocks when you convert land of the various types out of its natural state into production agriculture, you're losing somewhere north of 100 tons per hectare. So this 161 gigatons came from not having to more extensively cultivate land because of what we were able to do in terms of yields. And so what does that mean? What that means is if we had taken the yield looking forward from 2005 and say we aren't going to do any better than that in 2050, you know, we're going to need to almost double cropland on a global basis. And so the amount of emissions associated with that, so this is not the emissions associated with the actual agriculture, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. So it's not the emissions from methane from anaerobic fermentation in livestock or in rice fields. It's not the N2O from fertilizer use. This is just the land use implications if we aren't able to increase productivity. And so if I flip this around and I say, well, what if I hold cropland constant? Then what do I need to do? And so I have to get a similar jump in productivity between now and 2050 as we got between 1961 and 2005. So can technology deliver that? And I think we're quite optimistic that technology can deliver that. But what it says to us when we're looking at trying to reduce emissions, we can't reduce emissions outside of the context of productivity gains in agriculture. And so at this particular meeting, I'm really happy to be at the confluence of agronomy and crop science and soil science, because I think it's that set of those sets of expertise that are going to be critical to achieving a different trajectory. So what role do markets play? I mentioned that the green revolution happened largely with private players introducing more efficient, more productive processes, which they were roundly criticized for not having paid adequate, and rightly, for not having paid adequate attention to environmental questions. Markets in the carbon offset world are very small. So, in 2015, the U.S. had the largest volume of voluntary offsets, but it was only 15 million tons. And U.S. companies were the largest buyers, buying about 16 million tons. So that's the voluntary market. That means it can be a place where you can get support for pilot activities. But when I say pilot, I'm not thinking pilot in a research sense. I'm thinking pilot in a global sense. These markets are very nascent and only good for drawing attention to really good ideas that can then be disseminated in other ways. Compliance markets are a relatively new phenomena. I mean, the best example is the California market, where they've put together a combination of different market mechanisms in order to achieve reductions. So the American Carbon Registry is one of the approved registries in the state of California, and implementing oversight, verification, overseeing conflict of interest, making sure the methodologies are followed properly for the approved methodologies in California. And we helped champion a methodology for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from rice in California, which is now approved and operational. The intent with these projects is to find a much bigger marketplace. We've tried to do this across, we think that, we're a science-based organization, I guess, first off. And so we believe in peer-reviewed science being the guidepost for where real benefits can be achieved. And so we try to capture consensus positions on the peer-reviewed science in the methodologies that we develop and that we put forward. And so we have put together this set. I'm going to talk mostly today about the rice management ones, but we have a grazing land livestock management methodology that addresses a number of different pools where carbon or greenhouse gas emissions change. The fertilizer changes in fertilizer management and the N2O reductions associated with that. So I'm happy to answer questions on any of these. I'm going to try to zero in on rice as an example. Giving you just a sense, this is a paper from Lydia Olander back in 2011, where she and her team looked at a lot of different kinds of practice changes that could be introduced and what the potential tons per acre per year were for each of these practices, and then looked at how many million acres of land could there be. So part of the reason we initially put a lot of effort into rice, not just because our headquarters is in Arkansas, which is a large rice-producing region, but also because it is the place where we saw from the literature that the greatest opportunities in agriculture seem to exist. And this number that's up here is just the opportunity in the United States. So 3.2 million acres is a very small area, but I mean, rice is a major global crop, and what we learn here could be extended elsewhere. And then there's not just the changing water management practices, but there's also rice cultivars. Because the predominant patterns for growing rice have been flooded fields, the cultivars that are grown are best suited for productivity there. So one of the large criticisms of practices like alternate wetting and drying has been that the yield drops. So I spent some time emphasizing how important yield is, but yield is not only important in terms of the global carbon accounting, it's also very important in terms of the economic viability. So a farmer is not going to trade off a drop in yield for a better greenhouse gas profile, or even for better water use efficiency, or even for better soil organic carbon content, because in general, those things aren't things that they can translate into dollars as rapidly as, you know, a change in yield. In terms of pricing, because a lot of times I see articles and papers that talk about, well, if the price is this much, well, he can do this, and if it's this much, we can only do that. And the prices are sort of all over the place. But what you would expect in a normal, I mean, so here, the California compliance market, they do an auction. And so the offset prices in California are often driven by the allowance market. They have a floor price, which is $12.73. And so for the last several auctions, the offsets in the California market, the allowances in the California market have been trading at the floor. But still, $12.73, when I look at a lot of the papers in the literature, they were using numbers, you know, the ecosystem marketplace report for the voluntary market in 2015 showed an average price of just over $3 a metric ton. And on $3 a metric ton, even if you're doing great things in agriculture, it doesn't make any sense financially. If you look at what companies are doing, you can take a look at the Carbon Disclosure Project, which collects from a bunch of different companies, you know, what their internal pricing for carbon is when they're making their own investment decisions. And so of the 120 companies that reported this number, so the majority of companies under the Carbon Disclosure Project haven't reported this number, the price there is $18 a metric ton. So if that's an indicator of what's potential in the marketplace. I tend to think that lower prices or these sort of $10 to $20 prices are probably a sign of a healthy market going forward. And so that's the price that would be what you'd be looking at. Adam, in his Keith, in Adam's presentation, showed that the Paris Agreement, you know, now has been, I think it's up to 96. He had 94 as of
up to 100, actually. I looked last night.
Last night, yeah. So it keeps going up, and so people are signing on. But there's some really significant things about this agreement that have implications even for U.S. agriculture and crop science, and that is that under the nationally determined contributions, all countries are making a statement of what they're going to do. And so the market dynamics of a top-down CDM-style market are gone. And what you have instead is a bottom-up, how do you get more ambition into a marketplace set of interactions. And so there's going to be a lot of things that have to happen in order for there to be both government-led attempt to reduce emissions and a market-led impact on emissions. And so what do I mean by that? I think that national inventory science is really quite different from sector and project science. And so we see a lot of conflict between methodologies for how do you set your inventory versus, you know, how do you determine a project. And in a bottom-up kind of market, that causes problems. Because most likely the way the Paris framework is set up, if you want to, for example, transact in a compliance market, you'll have to show that the tons you're transacting are not part of what's already been committed by a national government's planned contribution. And those national government planned contributions are going to be based on inventories and inventory science and not necessarily covered by project science. And so someone who shows a great improvement in a project or in a sector, you know, say working with corn growers on nitrogen applications across 10 states in the Mid-South, you know, someone who can really move the needle someplace then has to say, well, how would this number that I'm calculating with real measurements that I have to verify, how does that end up in the national inventory? And the national inventory has a set of assumptions based off of tier one indicators for crops, which don't match up. So there's going to be a lot of kind of getting the science straight, and there'll be a lot of politics in getting the science straight, because it'll be important to have things come out one way or the other. And it's a place where I think the ag scientists in the United States have a really critical role to play in sort of getting the numbers and the details on those discussions right and making clear that standard practices on measurement are important, that transparency behind numbers is important, that markets don't work without transparency, they don't work without consistency. And so you're not going to get people paying for something that someone can make up in a black box that no one can see. So I'll make a few more comments about that. But the first marketplace, and so, oh, that's all talk, and it could go the same way that CDM did, and nothing's going to really happen. But the first place coming out, and there's been announcements about this just in the last couple of weeks, but it's a theme at in Marrakesh is the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. And so ICAO has approved its a program for reducing its emissions. You know, it feels that it has few options going forward for aviation fuel. Obviously, biofuels is one option for that, but they basically believe they're going to have to purchase offsets. So what they've approved in the past couple of weeks, the size of the ICAO market will be significantly larger than the California market. And that market also will be open to offsets from the United States. So unlike the CDM market, which was run through an international organization, the ICAO market is expected to let airlines choose the countries where they want to source their own emissions. And so one would expect that U.S. airlines, who have a big part of the international emissions, will want to source at least a portion of their offsets in the United States. The no double counting question will mean that the governments will have to approve any projects that are sold into the International Civil Aviation Organization market as a deduction from their national inventory reporting. And so we would expect that would go more easily in the United States. EPA and USDA have talked about that. I don't think it's going to be easy even there, but they're going to be interested. The negotiators have said they're interested in that outcome. Other countries, it might not be so easy to get approval because, in general, these are lower-cost options. You know, rice, just to give you sort of the numbers and the yield, if you look at the U.S. yield on rice, 2015 numbers, you know, 8.5 tons per hectare, global average 4.4. I'm going to come back to this point a little bit later. You know, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions in water, Lanier and Alley at the University of Arkansas did some work back in 2012-2013 with Bruce Lindquist from UC Davis. And, you know, they did four replicates of four different water treatments. I'm not going to go into the details of what these water treatments are because the important point is in pretty good research, they were able to demonstrate that alternate wetting and drying, they could, without the statistical significance, the 1% is not statistically significant. And so in terms of their flood versus alternate wetting and drying model, they were able to show a decrease in water use, decrease in methane. Notably, you'll see a big jump in N2O because methane and N2O usually work against each other. If the soil is wet, you get anaerobic, you get methane emissions, and you don't have much N2O. When the soil dries out, you get a lot of N2O coming off. But the net global warming potential measurements were strongly positive. Methane is the dominant one in rice systems. We've been working with some individual farmers on this to see, well, can you actually take these practices and apply them at scale? So this is Mark Isbell's zero-grade farm, 3,200 acres, continuous rice, zero-grade. So he's been able to demonstrate in his program 50% reductions in water use and 75% reductions in methane. This is just a trace. They've done measurements on, you can see the peaks and troughs associated with the draining there, but they've been able not only to produce this reduction, but they've segregated the rice from the production process. So they warehouse it differently, and they're thinking to try to market this to premium buyers who want to have sustainability in place. Lessons learned. We've tried a lot with biogeochemical models. They really require expert users and data management. It's difficult to operate. Revenue per acre is small, and the costs of verification are high. What I want to do here is, it shows up on the screen there. It didn't show up on my screen. Metrics matter. So these two charts, the chart on the left shows the ranking of emissions per hectare. So the United States is the worst emitter on an area basis for rice systems. But if you flip it around and you look at output per ton of rice, the United States is one of the best producers. And so it's these kinds of metrics that, in the absence of scientists getting involved and making clear how these things can work and should work to have comparable data, you'll see lots of efforts to misrepresent whose country's agricultural systems are more, have better performance and are more efficient. The anti-U.S. crowd will say, well, the United States, they use all those inputs, and therefore they're going to have a lot of emissions, and that's why they're the worst. Others will see the great yield gains, and the yields, you know, outweigh the area part. I'm out of time. We need more data. We need more data on both the things that we measure, but then also remote sensing techniques for verification. So thank you.